kind of cartoonish of the, some of these coverage of these topics because it's being done on the fly. But the good side of that is that if there's a particular topic you want to see, it's not too late to suggest it. So, I don't know if there's any questions from last time before I start. Is that so now let's kind of get past the standard model. So the last time was kind of summarizing the things that are special about the standard model. In particular, the one that's going to be playing a role now is that the standard model was the most general thing that could have been written down, given the gauge symmetries and the field content, with dimension 4 or less, and that by accident preserved baryon number symmetry and lepton number symmetry for each of the three species, the three generations of leptons. And so that's an example of a selection rule that whatever the physics is at high scales, if it breaks those symmetries and only has the standard model particles at low energies, you'd expect baryon number and lepton number to be approximately invariant, but not exactly invariant. So if we write down kind of in this scheme of things where we write things down in terms of dimensions, we had L0 and L2 and L4, and we've kind of talked about those. The next ones are L5 and L6, and you'll see that things start to blow up with L6. But the goal here is what we want to do is, what the question is, what's the most general? In the same way we wrote down the most general thing in the standard model involving the fields, the gauge fields, we have what is the most general? L5, consistent with SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 and containing only the standard model field. So that's, there's the three gauge fields. Let me just write them out. Just so I'm going to use A for an SU2 index, alpha for an SU3 index, I for a generation index, and we'll have L. I won't write the indices for these ones. E, B, U, and Q. These are the doublets, and these are the singlets, and the Higgs field. So and remember the convention is that the mass dimension of Ln is n. So the interesting thing about L5 is that there is a unique operator. So the claim is, and I think Weinberg was the first one to make this statement. And that is, and what you do is just to go through the exercise of, how many ways can you make things with dimension 5? You'd have to have used 5 bosons, or maybe 4 bosons and a derivative, or 3 bosons and 2 derivatives. And then, but you have to make a Lorentz invariant, so every time you have a derivative, you have to have something else to get rid of the index, so probably you have to have 2 derivatives. And you've got to go through all the possibilities, and the fermions each have mass dimension 3/2, so once you need 2 of them, otherwise you can't make the Lagrangian-Lorentz invariant. So if there's any fermions, there's 2. That already has a dimensions mass cubed. So then a third fermion you can't have because that wouldn't be Lorentz invariant. So you need 2 more fermions. That's already massed to the 6. So you could have 2 fermions and then derivatives and bosons. And so you kind of go through all the options. And then you ask that the SU3 and SU2 indices all contract nicely. And then you also then ask that the hypercharge of what's left is 0. And those conditions, nail this thing down uniquely to be L5 is some coefficient. Let's call it C5 over lambda. And then the unique thing you can write, so I should write the generation indices now, ij, is Li. I want to left-handed. I think I want to be left-handed here. Yeah. Actually, I'll just write the fields, and you can contract the indices the way you want to. Most complex conjugate. So basically, these are each doublets, And so you contract the indices to make a singlet, and all the hypercharges, L and phi have opposite hypercharge, so that's going to be hypercharge invariant as well. And then I and J are the generation indices. So that's something which, that's the only thing which is allowed at dimension 5. And it has, because it has a lepton field, two lepton fields, it has a lepton number plus 2. So, but there's no baryons here, there's no quarks, so it doesn't break baryon number. But that means that the only thing you can write down at dimension 5 level has the selection rule of delta L equals 2, the total lepton number. And if you, so that's the natural thing to ask is, so if it's true that the physics is at very high energies compared to the standard model, we would have expected the standard model to be to work really well, and it does. And then the first thing we'd expect to see as a deviation would be the lowest dimension correction, which in this case is L5. It's unique. What would it look like? Well, if we want to know what this means phenomenologically, what we have to do is we want to replace phi. It'll involve Higgs physics, but Higgs physics is kind of new. It hasn't been studied that much. But we can also replace the Higgs by its VEV. And if we do that, what happens is that this picks off the neutrino part of these doublets, and it leaves you with L5 is C5ij over lambda times nu I nu j plus times V squared plus complex conjugate. So that's a neutrino mass. And it's a Majorana mass because it's got delta L equals 2. And it naturally predicts a mass scale. That's the neutrino masses. There'll be a neutrino mass matrix, a left-handed neutrino mass matrix, which will be of the order of C5ij V squared over lambda, where lambda is some big scale. And I know that you guys in the standard model class looked at what would happen if you had had a right-handed neutrino. So if we had taken the standard model, so supposing our model was a right-handed neutrino model. So it's the standard model plus a singlet field N, which was a SU3 singlet, an SU2 singlet, and a hypercharged zero field. That's what you need to write down a Yukawa coupling between the lepton doublet. If we tried to write down something involving this one fermion here, the thing we'd have to write down here would be a singlet. And so that's, I know that Sean wrote this kind of a model down, and then you have some sort of a Yukawa coupling L n phi plus complex conjugate. And I won't be careful with the indices here. And I'm imagining here I've got one singlet for each generation, but really you could do whatever you like. You could have just one singlet period. Nothing forces you to have specific numbers of generations of these guys. And Sean went through the exercise of diagonalizing. So there's the total mass matrix for N and the regular neutrino. If you write down the mass matrix for the ordinary neutrinos and the heavy guys, this thing gives you something proportional to Y and then the VEV of the Higgs. There's nothing in the standard model that involves just two standard model guys. That would have been zero. And then this guy gives you somebody down here. And he went through the exercise in one generation of diagonalizing that matrix in the limit where M was much bigger than those two guys. And it predicted so what happens when you diagonalize this thing is that you pick up the smallest eigenvalues. The smallest, they go like, YV squared over M. And one way to see that graphically would be, if you think of this as an interaction, and if you imagine starting off with a standard model neutrino, then you can use one of these Y interactions to turn it into a heavy neutrino, which has a big mass, and then you can switch it back using the same Y interaction to get a regular neutrino. And so if you do the same thing we were doing before when we took heavy things and replaced them by their leading expansion at low momenta, this would become something like 1 over m because it's a fermion propagator, so it's going linearly in the mass. And this would lead you to a matrix a neutrino mass matrix, which looks like Y M inverse Y IJ is a matrix, which is kind of one way of seeing why this eigenvalue was, the small eigenvalue had this seesaw form. So that kind of relationship that says that what makes the neutrinos light, the explanation for why the neutrinos light is that something else is really heavy, is the seesaw kind of mechanism, which first came up in these kind of models. But you can kind of see that the what was really important here, what allowed you to get this kind of a theory, if we had integrated out, if these guys had been very heavy and we integrated them out to get the effective theory, would generate this kind of operator. This is exactly the kind of thing, this kind of a graph, if we'd put an arbitrary lepton here and a Higgs, would have, because there is a Higgs here, so we could have included the Higgses here. If we integrate out the heavy sterile neutrino, if the sterile neutrinos are heavy, we can integrate them out, and if we do, their leading contribution at low energies is exactly this operator. And the prediction would be that C5 over lambda would be given by this. And so it's an explicit expression in terms of the assumed couplings in the microscopic theory, in this case, the Yao-Kao couplings in the mass matrix that were given. But you can also see that if the seesaw structure, the fact that you get a mass which is going like the Higgs-Vev squared divided by some big scale, is really generic, because any theory that breaks lepton number by 2 units and at low energies only has the standard model as particles in it is going to look like this. And the first thing that will appear that can break lepton number is this, which automatically has 2 Higgs-Vevs and a heavy scale in the bottom, and that'll be what you're always going to get. So Sean, when he talked about this, said that this is a way of doing the seesaw mechanism, and he said there's other ways too. The reason why there's so many ways is that all you have to do is make a model where you've got lepton number breaking and that couples to the neutrinos, and you arrange for everybody who's light to be standard model states, and you're always talking about this operator at low energies, because you're measuring the neutrinos at really low energies, their masses. And so that seesaw structure is really generic. And so in this theme of comparing what's generic in the effect of Lagrangian to what you see in a model, you can see that the seesawness, if you find the smallness of neutrino masses is not really a big success of any one model, because essentially anything that breaks lepton number and gives you a Majorana type of a mass with only the standard model particle content will always give you a seesaw structure, because you needed the Higgs there to get the gauge invariance to work for the standard model particles. So if you're going to test that, that's good news and bad news. That means that there's a very robust understanding why neutrinos might be light. But a test for this picture would be it has to be breaking lepton numbers. So this is really a Majorana mass. So when Sean talked about tests of neutrino masses, one class of tests was oscillations, and that's certainly been seen, that we see oscillations, and so you believe there's a mass there. But another kind of test, that doesn't in itself test whether or not you broke lepton number, because you could have arranged things, you could have assigned lepton number to these ends in such a way that this was all lepton number invariant. And so you could have had a mass here which was lepton number invariant, where every neutrino is a Dirac neutrino rather than a Majorana neutrino. And the way to test for the Majorana-ness, the breaking of lepton number, is to look for things like double beta decay that he'd also talked about. The case where to be a Majorana means that you carry no, your antiparticle is the same as you are. It's like photons are Majorana in that sense, but for fermions is what you call them Majorana. And if you're not distinguishable from your antiparticle, then processes like double beta decay, where you have 2 neutrons, they both go to protons, and they would have had electrons and neutrinos as well, or antineutrinos. If the neutrino and the antineutrino are the same thing, then you can actually tie these things off and have them be annihilated with each other, and then you have 2 neutrons go to 2 protons and 2 electrons and nothing else. And kinematically, you can tell the difference. You can tell that happened, because this is really, these guys are all inside a nucleus, so the nucleus just sits there. So effectively what you had was a nucleus goes to another nucleus and 2 electrons. And because this is effectively a two-body decay, because the nucleus doesn't do anything, it just sits there. So the momentum and energy of these electrons had to add up to the release. And then you know that in a two-body decay, momenta are back-to-back, the energy has to sum up to whatever the energy release was. So that means that you have a unique value of energy. So you don't get a spectrum of decays, energies for the electrons, you get a specific energy. And Sean drew that picture for you. If you plotted the number of electrons versus energy, in ordinary beta decay, you get something like that. And also for double beta decay. But what you'd expect is just one kind of a line for neutrinos double beta decay, which they look for and have not seen. But the reason that it's an important experiment is that it tests this idea that your neutrinos are the same as their antiparticles. So it's testing conservation of lepton number. And should it be found that the prediction of this kind of a thing, the very generic prediction here would be that if you find neutrinos, that you're going to find them with Majorana masses, so lepton number will be broken and you will see that exotic decay. But because the scale could be quite large, and that's consistent with the masses of the neutrinos being quite small, it's kind of plausible you might not have seen it yet. You're looking for a very rare process. And so the good news is that's a very robust picture of why neutrinos are light. The bad news is, because it's robust, just measuring neutrino masses doesn't tell you a whole bunch about what was going on at high energies to give you those masses. And so that's why you don't really learn an enormous amount from neutrino masses. That anything, all you're really seeing is an operator like this. The other way in which you could imagine getting neutrino masses that would be different from this picture would be supposing some of these extra sterile neutrinos were light. If it happened to be that they were not up at some high energy scale, but they were down at an electron volt, so they could actually be being involved in experiments because they're in the low energy theory, that could change the picture of neutrino masses. And so people also look for that. They look for, in the same way that if you had light neutrinos that were sterile, you could have oscillations not just amongst the ordinary neutrinos, they could also oscillate into sterile neutrinos. And if you thought the neutrinos were weakly interacting, sterile neutrinos are really weakly interacting. And so if you produce a sterile neutrino, it basically escapes. So in a supernova or some sort of a thing where neutrinos are actually trapped by their interactions, the weak interactions, because things are so dense, sterile neutrinos even get out of that. So you can constrain the existence of sterile neutrinos, and there's no evidence for them either. But the interesting questions here are, you know, is it true that the lepton number is broken or not by the masses, given that we see masses? What are the other selection rules? Is CP preserved by these interactions? But the clues about what's going on at high energies are fairly scant. And the energies involved are quite high. So if you think that the evidence for neutrino masses, so we know that neutrino masses are something like 10 to the minus 2. We know that the differences of masses are something like 10 to the minus 2 EV. So let's say that that's what the mass is, just ballpark. If it's coming to us as something times V squared over lambda, if that's V squared over lambda and V is something like 250 GeV, then it says that lambda is going to be something like 10 to the minus, it'll be something like 250 GeV squared divided by that, which is 10 to the minus 11 GeV. So what is that? That's 250 squared is, let's call that 300 squared, which is 10 to the 5. And then this is 10 to the minus 11. That's 10 to the 16 GeV. So it's big, but it's not crazy big, right? It's still less than the Planck mass, which is 10 to the 18 GeV. But it's one of the pieces of evidence that there could be interesting physics happening just below the Planck mass. So all we really know is that there's this, the scale could be lower. I didn't imagine that there were, in this particular example, there were factors of these dimensionless Yukawa couplings, which maybe those are 10 to the minus 3. That would, if I had Yukawa couplings here, if I had some small factor in front, like a Yukawa coupling, then we would have had that here too, and lambda gets smaller by whatever those small factors are. So people will talk about the scale involved in neutrino masses as being 10 to the 16 GeV, maybe 10 to 11 GeV, and mostly they're arguing about the size of these dimensionless factors. But I forgot where I was going with that. Upshot is that there's circumstantial evidence that there's lepton number breaking happening at quite a high scale. That's kind of the take-home message. But it's not—it's only circumstantial because it might be that what we're looking at is something like this, where these neutrinos are light and not heavy. And so maybe there's not a seesaw mechanism going on. Maybe there really is a coupling like this with a light degree of freedom, a new light degree of freedom in the low energy theory. And that would be a different picture. And we right now don't know which of those is right. I'm kind of harping on that a little bit because this is the first example of something we're going to talk about more later, which is a portal. Because part of the evidence that the standard models can't be right is things like dark matter. It looks like there's stuff out there that's not heavy, or it's not so heavy that it doesn't exist in the universe. And that one way in which we, you know, the way we would fail to see something like that is that it would be coupled to us very weakly. And a good way to be weakly coupled is to be a singlet under the standard model, because that means that you don't have no gauge interactions. And the only thing you can do then is interact through some non-gauge interaction like this one. This is a renormalizable because these are fermions. So this has dimensions of mass cubed, and that's mass to the fourth. So that's dimensionless. So a portal is a renormalizable way that a singlet field of some spin can couple to the standard model. And the reason it's important is that singlet fields that don't couple through a portal are coupling through some non-renormalizable interaction suppressed by some heavy scale. At low energies, you would expect that if there's other fields out there that we don't know about yet, but they're light, it's still true that the dominant interactions at low energies will be the renormalizable ones because they're not suppressed by the heavy scale. So it's particularly interesting to identify how standard model particles could couple in a renormalizable way to the singlet particles. And there's three known ways of doing that. One of which is this one. This is the neutrino portal. So you guys should, between now and Friday, think about what the other two might be. So there's the and it's a simple exercise. It's the same kind of exercise as you did when you wrote down the standard model, but now what you're doing is you're saying, I'm not making a Lagrangian which is invariant under Lorentz transformations. I'm asking for what combinations of standard model fields I can write down that are gauge invariant. But I don't care if they're Lorentz invariant because the other field, the singlet field, will carry the Lorentz quantum numbers to make it a singlet. So in this case, the observation was like that L and phi together is a gauge invariant combination, even though it's not Lorentz invariant because it's a spinner times a scalar. But I can make it Lorentz invariant if I have a singlet fermion. And so that'll make the portal. So you should think about how many ways you can make low dimension gauge invariant quantities in the standard model. Forget about the Lorentz indices. And if they have Lorentz indices, that'll tell you what the spin is of the sterile particle you need to get a renormalizable interaction. So if you go through that exercise, it's not that hard, and there's not that many things in it, and there'll be three answers, one of which is that one. And if you look at dark matter models, they basically thread all of the three different portals people have thought about, because that's the place. When you're being systematic, that's the place to look for physics that's at low energies, coupling in a weak way to the standard model. All right, any questions about that? That's kind of, yeah.
So let me know if I understood well, but so because this is the most generic thing that you can write in for L5,
yeah.
Then you are saying that these credits for, like, let's say them that the neutrinos have Dirac masses?
So the statement is that if whatever's going on in the theory of the world, if it only had at low energy standard model particles,
Then
this is where the masses would have to come from, and so it would therefore be true that they would have lepton number violating masses. But what we don't know is that the assumption there is that the only particles at low energies were the standard model particles. If you had a theory like this where these ends were light, then the new thing that would change this argument would be that I'm supposed to build this thing out of the standard model fields plus n. And so now I can write down this new interaction like this one. And this would give me a mass just by itself. I wouldn't need this. And I could arrange this to be lepton number preserving if I wanted to, just by assigning lepton number to n in such a way that it makes everything work. And in that case, I would not get this. This would be forbidden by lepton number conservation in that case. But the fact that I could have written it down, but I don't write it down, would tell me that somewhere in the world there's something telling us a lepton number is conserved, and it wasn't just low energies like it is in the standard model. Given that I knew that there's a new field here that could have allowed lepton number breaking or preserving interactions, and if I don't see this, then that means that something at high energies is giving. I've got now information about high energies that it's preserving lepton number, and that did not just follow from the gauge invariance. That was an additional assumption. Whereas without these guys, there was nothing in my starting point which would forbid this. So if I didn't see it, if it turns out that it was not there, it's kind of hard to, if we had not seen it, we wouldn't know if maybe lambda was too big. But given that we do see it, we do see a mass, it's kind of very suggestive, but it's not completely compelling that there has to be lepton number breaking, because it could have been that there were other light fields around that we just haven't seen yet. And the fact that there's dark matter suggests that there probably are other light fields around. So the weakest part of this argument I'm making now is that I'm using only the standard model fields. Okay, so let's move on to dimension six. And dimension six, actually, when I was your age, I thought that the standard model stuff had all been written down for millions of years, and it had at some level, because when I was a graduate student, the standard model was almost 20 years old. And you guys must think that's even more true. But I tell you that because the list of interactions at dimension six level was actually only properly done in the last 5 to 10 years. And there's no reason why someone couldn't have done this, you know, back in the day. People wrote down a list of what these operators could have been, but it was a too long list. It was redundant. So it included operators that were really could be obtained from each other by doing field redefinitions. So people only got systematic and wrote down a basis of operators for these interactions. And that's what you really want to know when you're renormalizing things. In the last, certainly less than 10 years, might have been less than 5 years. And the running of them, which is a pure standard model calculation, was only done in the last 3 years or something like that. So it's or maybe 4 years. So it's worth being, don't assume that people before you have kind of exhausted all the things that can be done even with the standard model. It's there are corners often that get overlooked because people are following the sexy train, and sometimes that's the wrong train. But that's an example, a surprising example to me. If I'd known that when I was a student, I would have done that calculation. Although, you know, it's also true, in those days, we didn't know the Higgs was real. So you didn't know that this is really the right Lagrangian. So there's always something which will make you doubtful. So that's another reason why just jump in. You know, you can't really, sometimes you'll be wrong, sometimes you'll be right. All right, dimension six, so L6. So there's a whole bunch of them, and I'm not gonna write them all down, but the, next time I will bring, I guess, a reference for that, for the list. So they call it the Polish list, because the people who wrote it down correctly for the first time were Polish. And I'll get you that reference for next time. But in particular, contained in that list are some the first interactions that violate baryon number invariance. So there's delta B unequals zero interactions. And whereas there's a whole bunch of these things that are delta B preserving, you know, in the ballpark of 100 maybe or something, maybe might be less than that. But there's only six of these. So that's the list I can, so these were written down in 1979 or something like that. So it was done much, much earlier. So let me tell you what they are. So this is the delta B not equal zero list, assuming we have only standard model fields. So it has the form of, there's six of them. So let me write 1 to 6. I'll call these coefficients Cn, Ij, Kl, where those are the generation indices, because they're all four fermion operators. I'll call this O-N I-J-K-L. So I'll just write down what the six O-Ns are. So O-1 I-J-K-L is, now remember, these are color indices, and I kind of lied to you a little bit over here. I made it sound like color was going to be the octet index, but I'm really going to use it over there as if it's a triplet index. So I shouldn't have made a big deal about using the same letter here. So we have, this is an SU3 tensor, the invariant tensor. For SU2, I have the same thing, MN. And now I'm going to suppress the Lorentz indices because they're going to be contracted. Everything in a bracket will be contracted to be a Lorentz singlet. We have Q. Now there's Q. I guess if I want to write the indices the same way I wrote them here, write I, M, gamma left, L, N, J, D bar. Let's say just write D. And let me get my notation straight here. Yeah, I'm going to write bars. K, alpha, gamma right, U, L, beta. So there's a gamma missing, which would be here. So let's say alpha, beta, gamma. So these guys are each, they each carry a color quantum number. And I guess I deliberately didn't want to write the bar there. For this to make sense, these things have to all transform the same way in order to contract them with a three-index color tensor. And so here I've got a right-handed up. Then this would I would want, so that's an anti-triplet. So I want this to be anti-triplet, so it also has to be right-handed up, so I don't want to complex conjugate it. And here, I do want to complex conjugate it because this is a left-handed field, which I'm then complex conjugating. That's why I'm sometimes writing bars and not bars. So O2 IJKL is epsilon alpha beta gamma epsilon MN. There's now Q M I alpha gamma left Q N J beta U, J, K, gamma, gamma right, E, L, and O, three. Alpha, beta, gamma, M, N, Q, M, I, alpha, gamma left, Q, N, J, beta, Q bar, and then let's say R, gamma, K, gamma left, L, R, L. So here, the thing in the bracket is the same thing. I just have I'm just contracting the SU2 indices differently. Instead of using epsilon, I'm using a Pauli matrix and times epsilon dotted with each other. Is there a question? Someone? Yeah.
The D there in the first term, it's the down quark.
That's the down right-handed down quark. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm gonna try and avoid there'll be no derivatives here. So it's the thing that would be confusing would be that D and the covariant D.
Yeah.
So there will be no derivatives in these things. So I'm trying to avoid writing covariant derivatives because I'm using D in that way. So everything here is a field. And I'm not being very explicit about how the indices get contracted. Like the sometimes these fields are complex conjugates of the original field. And there's also going to be a complex conjugate to everything I write down is not real necessarily. But you can kind of read off what the quantum numbers are and then connect them the indices together yourself. Based on I've told you which tensors are appearing. Huh? So that's the logic of it. So.
And why is there not derivatives in these terms?
Because that would cost me another dimension. I wrote each fermion is mass to the 3/2, so this is mass cubed.
Yep.
This is mass cubed, and so now we've already got mass to the 6.
Okay.
And we're just writing down dimension 6 things. So a derivative would be dimension 7 if we could do it. You need two derivatives because you have to contract that index somehow.
Yeah.
But that would be there in principle, but it's something which is going to be more suppressed by this heavy scale lambda. So this will be a priori dominant. So the unless there's some selection rule at work, this should be the one that wins. or these should be the ones that win. And there's epsilon, alpha, beta, gamma. U bar I alpha, gamma right. U j beta. U bar k gamma, gamma right el. No six is similar to that. So that's a list. The nice thing about lists are that they're exhaustive. And so that tells you, so what's interesting about that is that this list is predictive. So that physics, if we had generic physics at high energies that was giving us baryon number violating physics, that meant the baryon number was actually violated, and it just, we were protected from that by accident because we couldn't write down a baryon number violating interaction at dimension lower than the L6. If we're looking at a generic situation, the low energy limit of that baryon number violating physics should be given by those operators, and those do not give you generic, those satisfy selection rules that are not true for all theories. And so so there's some things you can get right away that will be generic things that you would expect to be true for when you're looking for baryon number violation. Let me, where did I write them down here? So first of all, they all satisfy, so properties. So these things, every one of them has the property that delta B is one, or plus or minus one. Because they all involve three quarks and a lepton, and each quark has baryon number a third. And so, and if you work it out, it's never the anti-quark that's appearing here, it's always the quark. So it's always true that delta B is one. If it's one here, it'll be minus one in the complex conjugate term. So you've got that selection rule. That means right away that, how would you look for baryon number violation? Well, the reason people think that, they historically thought the baryon number was a good symmetry was, nuclei don't decay or protons don't decay. So ways to seek delta B unequals zero experimentally. The obvious class is nucleon decays, baryon decays. Actually, I should say nucleon decays. By which I really mean protons, because neutrons, free neutrons do decay with weak interactions, but not a nuclei. But also you could have had things like, in the same way you have KK bar mixing or you have neutrino mixing, if you have a neutral particle which doesn't carry any conserved quantum numbers, it can always turn into its antiparticle. And that's what happens for neutrinos once they have a mass. Once you break the lepton number, that would have distinguished the particle from the antiparticle. Or for kaons, once the weak interactions break the strangeness that would have distinguished the K from the K bar. Or neutrons. Neutrons, the only thing they carry that keeps them from turning into antineutrons is baryon number, because they don't carry electric charge. So you can look for neutron-neutron bar oscillations. That could happen. If that happened in a nucleus, it would be dramatic. If all of a sudden a neutron in the nucleus turned into an antineutron, that antineutron would annihilate with another neutron, and then you'd have a whole bunch of energy coming out. So the fact that that doesn't happen is also pretty well known, but you can look for it happening occasionally. But this has the property that it satisfies delta B equals 2, whereas this is delta B equals 1, if you're looking for a nucleon to decay. And so right away, you can see that if this is what the story is, if all you have is standard model particles at low energies, you're not going to see this. Because that's something, in order to see this, you either have to go to higher dimension in the standard model fields, or you have to have other fields around besides the standard model ones. But that tells you that neutron-neutron oscillations, antineutron oscillations, on the one hand, they're unlikely to be seen if you're looking for that, but they're very informative if you see them, because they're not the generic thing you'd expect. That's one thing you learn. Another thing you learn is these things all satisfy that delta B equals delta L. So B minus L is conserved. So that says that that also constrains how the nucleon can decay. So so you'll never get a proton decaying into a pi plus pi zero, say, because this has baryon number one, lepton number zero, so B minus L is one here, but this has B equals zero and L equals zero. So that would be forbidden because that's conserved. But you can get things like P goes to E plus pi zero, say, because that has B minus L is equal to one, and that's got B minus L is equal to one. There's also a whole bunch of other ones like, you can look at the isospin properties, the ups and down quarks and the strange quarks. You can track them, and I won't. But because of the isospin invariance, you can make statements that relate, because there's a symmetry that relates, you know, isospin, remember, I don't know if you guys saw, but isospin is the symmetry, it's the vector symmetry which shuffles, you multiply the up quark and the down quark by both the left-hand and right-handed pieces by a 2x2 unitary matrix. That's SU2 isospin. That's what makes the nuclear force not care if it's talking about protons and neutrons. They basically, it's nuclear physics is do good approximation isospin invariant. And because that relates the up and down quarks, and those are the ones involved in protons decaying, you get to make predictions along the lines of, I'll just give you some of them. The proton, the rate, whatever the rate is for proton going to pi naught lepton plus, right-handed, that has to be equal to one-half the rate for the neutron to go to pi minus L plus right-handed. And there's other things like that. So there's the fact that you've got a symmetry relating these decays, because these things all satisfy the symmetry we're talking about, gives you a bunch of quantitative information about the relative size of different rates. It doesn't tell you how big the first one is. But once you know that, you know what all these other ones are. So there's information in this list that there's not just everything that could have happened happened. It's specific kinds of things can happen. And lastly, the size of this coefficient. I didn't write the coefficient here, lambda squared, but I probably should have done. We're expecting everything to be suppressed by some lambda. And in the same way that here, there was a statement about how big, if we believe this is where neutron or neutrino masses came from, the measured values of the masses turned into an estimate for how big lambda could be, and it was quite big, but not crazy big. So we can do the same thing here. There's a constraint on how small lambda can be, because the smaller lambda is, the less suppressed these are, and so the more these things will be important, and in particular, the more you're going to get nucleon decay. So the fact that you have not seen nucleon decay says that at some level, the rate for these things, the rates for the reactions that these things mediate is less than some amount. And that means that this coefficient is less than some amount, which means that there's a lower bound as to how big lambda can be. So we can estimate that. That's coming from the neutron lifetime, or the proton lifetime. And I'm flogging this a little bit because what's grand unified theories in many ways are very pretty. And one of the pretty things is that there's a constraint on how big lambda can be coming from proton decay. And then there's a separate argument that tells you how big it should be, predicted to be, that gives you the same answer, which is kind of an attractive feature of the models. So first, let's get the grant. So there's a constraint on lambda for delta B unequals 1 or equals plus or minus 1 interactions. So we've got some interaction which has the form of some order one number divided by lambda squared times some operator which satisfies that delta B is equal to 1. So we know that the rate for proton decay, proton goes to something. We just want to estimate that. Then what we know is that to leading order, it's going to be given by the amplitude for the decay will be the matrix element of the something times L delta B equals 1 with a proton in it. And then what we're supposed to do is get the rate as being the integral of that amplitude squared times the D3P over the energy for all the final state particles. There's some expression like that. So we know right away that that is going to be an order of magnitude. It has to be proportional to this coefficient squared, because this amplitude would be proportional to that, and we square it. So we're going to get something which goes like 1 over lambda to the fourth, Then we do a lot of integrals, but those integrals are all integrals that run from, you know, zero to the biggest energy that the decay products can carry, and that biggest energy is the proton mass in the proton rest frame. So there'll be some integral to do, and might be complicated, might not be complicated, but on dimensional grounds, unless there's some other scale in the problem, it's going to be, if the things that we're decaying into are light compared to the proton, then we can neglect their masses, and then all that's left is the proton mass. And since this is one over a lifetime, it has dimensions of mass, whatever the integral is, it has to give you the proton mass to the fifth power, and then there'll be some number up front, which will involve 1 over 2 pi squared probably, and then other stuff. So what we know experimentally is that the lifetime is at least 10 to the 25 years or something like that. Where is the statement? 10 to 33 years. You know, the age of the universe is 10 to the 17 years or something like that, or 10 to the 12 years. And you do this because you have a shitload of protons and you watch them all and none of them decay. So we need this in GeV. So, you know, a year is pi basically times 10 to the 7 seconds. And 200 basically 200 MeV, which is 1 over a Fermi, is also 1 over 10 to the minus 23 seconds. So this is 3 times 10 to the 7 seconds, and a second is times 10 to the 23 over 0.2 GeV. I did that right? 3 times 10 to the 30. That's 5, so that's, now we have 15, 1.5 times 10 to the 31. Let's call that 1, GeV to the minus 1. And so this is bigger than, so the rate, which is 1 over tau, is less than 1 over 10 to the 33 years. So that's 1 over 10 to the 33 times 10 to the 31 GeV minus 1. That's less than, so it's of the order of 10 to the minus 63 GeV. Make sure I did that right here. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Close enough for government work. There you go. So that means that, so lambda, so this thing, this is the thing that's equal to this, right? So it's, this is the proton mass to the fifth divided by lambda to the fourth. That means the lambda to the fourth has to be larger than m proton to the fifth divided by this, m to the minus 63 GeV. Proton mass is a GeV, basically. Yeah?
Why is it the m proton mass to fifth?
Yeah. Oh, on dimensional grounds, because this is 1 over a time. So that means that that's a mass in these units. And I knew that I had to have, it was some integral over phase space where the integral was running from 0 to the proton mass. And if let's say the things we're decaying into are all really light compared to the proton mass, so then the only thing in that integral is the upper limit to set the scale. So on dimensional grounds, that integral will be some number times the proton mass to the fifth power. And it's the fifth power because that gives me the right dimensional answer. And there's no other scale in the problem if the masses of the decay products are small. That's a very general, in general, what I would have put here is the phase space, the amount of energy in phase space available to me, to whatever the power is I need to get the dimensions right. And so if you're doing a beta decay where you were not releasing the whole mass of the particle, but you're just releasing some fixed amount of energy, then this kind of an estimate also gets it right. So it's you're just basically using the fact that this integral is a complicated integral, but the complication is getting in the number, not the size. The scale is being set by the available energy in the decay. So if I've done this right, then this is basically a GeV. So what we got is 10 to the, I'm going to say 64 because that I can divide by 4. 64 GeV to the fourth. So that's 10 to the 16 GeV to the fourth. And you recognize that number. So that's the same kind of number we were getting for the neutrino mass scale. So what this says is that if you're going to violate Baron number, and if the reason you haven't seen it at low energies, if the reason you haven't seen it yet in proton decay is because all you have is standard model particles, and the only thing you could have, the leading thing you could have decayed with is this dimension 6 interaction, then whatever the scale is, you're relying on the scale lambda being large to make the decay rare, and this is how large it has to be. And so, again, it's big, But it's not crazy big, because it's less than the Planck scale. So you can imagine doing physics there and not having to understand quantum gravity. And so it makes sense to talk about it. And it would also be true, you know, I told you generically that if I integrate out physics, all the interactions, basically the scale that appears here is the scale that you last integrated out. And that's generically true. But if there's a selection rule that forbids you, if the last particle that broke baryon number was very heavy and I integrate it out, then all the baryon number violation is now in these dimension six operators. If I let them mix with one another, they always carry this 1 over lambda squared in front of them, so that it will be true that if I'm looking at an operator in effective theory which breaks the symmetry, which the rest of the theory is preserving, its coefficient can be small because the symmetry is protecting it from getting large contributions. So the whole thing would hang together if it were true that there were baryon number violating physics up at the 10 to the 16 GeV, and coincidentally, that physics would if you broke baryon number, it's not going to break B minus L, so you're also breaking L, and so that could also generate these neutrino masses, and at scales which would not be so far from what you would need to get the masses that we see. So that's kind of an intriguing piece of numerology. So what about in the neutrino mass case, you could write down an explicit model. So let me now talk about the grand unified theories that give you these models. And the popular ones actually only give you these, they basically only give you these interactions. And they don't give you the rest, because these are the ones you get by exchanging a spin one particle as opposed to a spin zero particle or something else that could have given you baryon number violation. So the non-supersymmetric grand unified theories typically give you these interactions and not these, for which there's now more information because there's fewer interactions here. There'll be more selection rules and more predictive power. And that's one of the ways where comparing what's generic to what the model gives you is useful. So let me just kind of start off reminding you what Sean told you before stopping. I'll say a little bit more than he did just because I know that some people asked about this stuff, and so, and he, I think, just told you how the standard model particles fit into SU5 representations, and I'll kind of elaborate a little bit, but it'll again be cartoon. So this is an example of B violating physics at very high energies. And part of this story will be there'll be one more piece of circumstantial evidence that there could very well be physics up there at those energies, coming from the unification of the couplings. That they, given that we know what the gauge couplings are in the standard model, and the grand unified theories, so what we're going to look at here is grand unified theories. And so the picture here will be, if you didn't like the SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 structure, which allowed you to have a separate coupling constant for each, and they were different because the strong interactions are stronger than the weak interactions, and the SU2 coupling is bigger than the electromagnetic one, I think. Anyway, they're different. The idea of grand unified theories is that you embed them, really what's going on, you know, this symmetry here in the standard model gets broken down to U1 electromagnetism at some scale set by the Higgs valve. Maybe there was a bigger group that was a semi-simple group, or it was a simple group where you didn't have factors that were independent of one another, and so they all had the same, forced to have the same coupling constant by gauge invariance that breaks at some higher energy down to this group. So is there a larger group, SU3 cross SU2, such that G only has one gauge coupling? And spontaneous symmetry breaking. breaks G to SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 at some large scale. And based on the discussion of a proton decay, we're expecting that, given that these series are going to give you proton decay, that scale is probably going to have to be up there, like 10 to the 16 GV. I'm going to call it MX because there's going to be a new particle in the theory, X. And the answer, as you know from Jacques, your hands up? if you do have a question, just yell it out because I'll just, I won't notice you. So you know that the answer, the short answer is yes. And there's more than one. So SU5 is the simplest one that came first, or then SO10 came along. So this is the one for which the standard model fermions fit into a representation with no extra extras needed. Let's say exactly fit. And this is one where if you add a sterile singlet plus the standard model, exactly fits. And then there's other ones, there's E8 and so on, which people explored when they were exploring these models. So what I'm going to focus on is the simplest one. But I'll say a little bit more than just how the fermions fit in, because I want to get to the argument about how the extra symmetry in the problem makes it more predictive in many ways. And so then, but part of what complicates that prediction is that you're making a prediction at very high energies, and then this issue of how couplings were normalized as you integrate out physics to get down to low energies where we live will actually make an important difference. It'll convert what looks like a wrong prediction into one that has a chance of not being wrong. It's also the thing that allows you to say, how can it be possible to have one gauge coupling in the full theory and have it look like we have different gauge couplings at low energies? That sounds like it just has to be wrong because we measure these things to be different. And again, it'll be the running of these couplings between the very high energies and low energies that will be allow us to have the fact that these are different experimentally be consistent with the fact that at high energies they could have been similar to each other. But that statement will rely on the scale MX being high because everything runs logarithmically. All the couplings run like logarithms. So to get a big order one change between them, you have to run a long way. And so the distance in energy space you need to make these couplings become the same will also point to a scale like 10 to the 16 GeV, independently of this argument that you would need that to make protons not decay, which is kind of the interesting numerology. And maybe that's a good place to stop. So the plan next time would be to pick this up, finish, I'll kind of give you a cartoon of grand unified theories, including culminating in this argument about how the couplings run and why that leads you to a prediction for what MX would be. And then also, the other predictions you get to make are there's relationships amongst the masses, that there's the, since there's more symmetries in the problem, there's constraints, that there's predictions that relate quark masses to lepton masses, say, because they're all sitting together in one multiplet. And for instance, in one of the ways of doing it, you predict that the electron mass is equal to the down quark mass, which sounds like it's just wrong. But the thing is that they have to be, those predictions have to be run down to low energies. And then once they've run, they look better. Although not completely good. And then the last topic, depending on how much time we have, will be, once we talk about running, you'll see that there's a general formula for how these couplings run. And that together with the hierarchy problem will lead into supersymmetry, because supersymmetry is partly motivated by the property that it can solve the hierarchy problem. But that's looking bad now because it's not been found at the LHC. So it's kind of you could take that one or leave it. But it's also true that supersymmetry makes ultraviolet properties simpler, and it's easy to see that once you see how the couplings run, that we group things, fermions and bosons together, and things will stop running at some point. And so that'll be the end point, unless there's topics that you want to cover that I haven't got on that list, which you can still add because I haven't made the lectures for next time yet. So we'll see you on Friday.